This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Yesterday, we learned that depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues are more common in children, youth, and adults with developmental disabilities, and that our current systems of care, one size fits all, may not always be helpful. How can we make our care more aligned and appropriate? This is the topic of our first speaker this morning, Brian Talent, a licensed professional counselor and associate director at Rocky Mountain Services, Denver, Colorado. Brian has been a counselor and administrator in the community mental health field for close to 30 years. He is a contributing member of the National Child Traumatic Stress Networks and serves on the board of directors of NADD. He conducts workshops nationally and internationally on adapted mental health treatments for people with IDD. Please welcome Mr. Brian Talent.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, I want to thank everybody for having me today to talk about trauma recovery and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I have to start off by saying this work began around 2005. Actually, the money to help with this project came out of the 9/11 tragedy, where the federal government recognized shortly after the 9/11 tragedy that we don't have a lot of good adapted or good trauma treatments for children who have, basically didn't have any good evidence-based practice for treating trauma in children. And so the federal government set aside money to create the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And their focus is to disseminate information about how to do the best evidence-based practice for treating trauma in children and disseminate that throughout the country. When I was at the Aurora Mental Health Center in Aurora, Colorado, we had a specialized clinic, a mental health clinic for youth with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we wanted to become a part of NCTSN. And as a part of when we submitted our proposal, we put in some of the statistics that show the high rates and disproportionate rates of trauma for people with disabilities. And it really caught the attention of NCTSN. And so I just wanted to direct your attention and let you know that there are some wonderful tools on the NCTSN website for supporting children with developmental disabilities who've experienced trauma, in particular, the Road to Recovery, which is probably the most comprehensive and contemporary work on the subject. And all you have to do is go to the website and register for free, and you can download that. There's also lots of fact sheets and webinars on traumatic stress and children with developmental disabilities. And I have to give a little bit of a props, too, to the National Association for the Dually Diagnosed, who has supported this work and contributed, and especially around the support of adults who have experienced trauma who have developmental disabilities. And so one of the things we recognized is that And when we start to look at best practices in treating trauma, we recognize that many of the older, outdated methods go immediately into processing the trauma. And what we recognize is that there's a lot of foundation and groundwork that needs to happen before people are ready to do that type of exposure therapy. And so we recognize that phase-oriented treatment is now focuses on skill building and mastery that is needed in order to do that type of exposure therapy. So developing positive approaches that emphasize strengths and recovery, developing guidelines and empirical support that build therapist confidence, these are all the trends that that are developing these newer models that are much more effective. But first, when we talk about adapting that for people with developmental disabilities, we have to dispel some myths, first of all, that people with developmental disabilities don't have the same response to trauma as people in the general population, and that people with developmental disabilities can't benefit from therapy. Because the facts are is that many different types of therapy have been found to be effective in treating people with developmental disabilities as long as the appropriate adaptations are made. People with IDD are less likely to recover spontaneously from trauma without treatment because we know that intellect is just simply one of many resilience factors that support the spontaneous recovery from trauma when it happens. And although it takes a little longer for people with IDD to make those changes, once those changes are made, they're stable and are skills that people can utilize throughout their lifespan. But there are some community realities that we have to deal with. First, that there's few mental health professionals that are trained to meet the needs of people with developmental disabilities. And I'm not talking from just a clinical perspective. I'm talking about a cultural competency. For people who do have a specialization in mental health and development disabilities, we recognize that this is the same dynamic and same set of tools that therapists need that are related to working with other minority groups that we may not have much experience or exposure with. So this is truly a cultural competency, and it does help to have some clinical knowledge about neurodevelopmental issues. But with a 2021 population of 332 million people, that's 7 million people in the U.S. who have a developmental disability. So you can even just imagine that if there's any sort of community disaster, at least 2% of the population is going to require some adapted form of treatment. And they shouldn't be left out. Because obviously trauma takes many forms in terms of natural disasters, accidents, invasive medical procedures, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. These are just a few. But as we'll talk in just a minute, you can recognize right off the bat that there's special vulnerabilities that people with IDD have in the community. And so we just have to validate, first of all, that this population is in need of trauma treatment, because in spite of the underreporting that happens, people with disabilities have a higher instances of most traumas. Some meta-analysis show that people with IDD experience 2.5 to 10 times the abuse of people without disabilities. They're 4 times likely to be victims of crime. In institutional settings, they're 2 to 4 times as high as risk in the community. So that's just a little bit of good news, is that actually these numbers, these are older studies from the 1990s. But as we look at some of the more recent studies where people are more integrated into the community, these numbers are actually better. But not much. I'm going to go over these really quickly, because I wanted to have these in here for your reference. But there's certain dynamics, like having a relationship to your abuser because of your disability, having it permanent. It's kind of a wicked two-way street. Some people have their disability as a result of abuse, neglect, and trauma, and people receive abuse and neglect and trauma because of their disability. So it's culturally, it's hard, as in terms of cultural competence, it's hard not to deal with trauma when working with people who have an IDD. Because child maltreatment is a factor in 10 to 25% of all developmental disabilities. The largest nationwide study on this issue was done by Dr. Nora Baladarian and the Disability and Abuse Project from California, who in 2012 did a very large study of people with disabilities and the prevalence of abuse. And if you take a look, compared to those 1990 studies, it's a little bit better, but not a lot. But if you ever have the opportunity to take a look at the details of the Disability and Abuse Project, I encourage you to look that up, because Dr. Baladarian did an absolutely fantastic job of breaking down not only the prevalence from this extensive survey, but was able to also break it down in terms of disability type. And so it really is fascinating. We don't have the time to go into it today, but if you look at the frequency of the abuse, still, in 2012, more than 90% of people with disabilities who were victims of abuse said they had experienced such abuse on multiple occasions. So when we're talking about treating trauma in people with IDD, it's not typically a discrete episode of trauma. It's typically, this is what happened when I was 7. This is what happened when I was 12. This is what happened when I was 15. And so we'll address that, and we'll talk about the phase-oriented trauma treatment. But unfortunately, these are typically multiple traumatic events that people have experienced. And it's all because of the unique vulnerabilities that people with IDD have. A higher level of assistance from caregivers needed throughout the lifespan, higher levels of stress on the family when the caregiving goes on for years and years beyond what's developmentally typical. The cognitive disability itself interferes with the person's ability to predict high-risk situation, or maybe even understand what's happening in an abusive situation. And then there's the barriers to reporting in terms of mobility, ability to communicate. When I was a behavioral specialist in the early 90s, completely undertrained before there was such thing as a BCBA, we were writing behavior programs that were simply compliance programs. So we know that people with IDD systemically are trained to be compliant to authority figures, and their social isolation. Again, culturally, we recognize that people with IDD experience social isolation. And so that increases their responsiveness to attention and affection in situations that maybe make them easier to manipulate, for predators to manipulate. They're less likely to be provided with general sex education or any type of training around human sexuality. And then we just simply have the stigma of disability, where people may not be valued in terms of access to healthcare, especially behavioral healthcare, and acknowledgement of what's happened to them. So that's kind of the backdrop of what I wanted to speak about today. I also wanted to get into talking about phase-oriented trauma treatment for children that has been adapted for working with children, adolescents, transition age youth, and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And it's based on Cohen, Mandarino, and Deblinger's book, Treating Trauma and Traumatic Grief in Children and Adolescents. And this was the foundation. It's a fantastic book if you're a clinician to start here. But then don't stop there. Go to the TFCBT Training Resources website where there is a web-based training available. And I just found out last night that if you go to the TFCBT MUSC-EDU website, they just added the manualized adaptation manual for people with developmental disabilities. So this project started back in 2005. And just last night, that product has been uploaded to the TFCBT website. And Cohen, Mandarino, and Deblinger have acknowledged that we now have effective manualized trauma treatment for people with IDD. So please, I'm sorry I don't have the website. I have the website here, but you have to search for that since it was just added yesterday. So why did we choose TFCBT to adapt for people with IDD? It's because it's strength-based. It focuses on developing competency skills, and it uses cognitive behavioral treatment techniques that are relatively easy to adapt for developmental levels. I mean, it was actually designed for children, which obviously children come at different developmental levels. And so it was naturally set up already to address the varying degrees of abilities. And so it's already structured to do that. Additional reasons for adaptations. One of the reasons is because of the negative impact on people with disabilities and their impaired resilience. And TFCBT focuses on developing those skills that are associated with greater resilience. So strong self-esteem, ability to self-soothe, feelings of competency, all of those are really important aspects that are woven throughout the entire model. And it can be used for single episode trauma as well as complex post-traumatic stress, which is typically people that have experienced early onset of abuse and neglect in multiple instances. So before we get into the phases of treatment, I want to start off by talking about just general adaptations to psychotherapy that are very important for people with IDD, and that is to slow down your speech. Use language that's comprehensible. Meet your client where they're at. Present information one at a time. Take frequent pauses during the session to check for comprehension. These are all things that are very important for facilitating communication and making adaptations for treatment. Now, it does require more patience, and it does require that the manualized TFCBT model originally was about 12 sessions, but that's not typical for people with IDD. Usually we're in many more sessions than 12, but always incorporate multisensory input. And not just rely completely on the spoken word. Make specific suggestions for change and allow time to practice those skills, and never assume that information is going to generalize to new situations. And in order for you to help those skills generalize, you have to include multiple caregivers in various environments. So these are all key components to adapting psychotherapy or basically any sort of treatment for people with IDD. And we look specifically at TFCBT, trauma-focused CBT, it's a family therapy model. So the sessions are generally divided between time of the client, time with caregivers, and sometimes both. So the non-adapted model is about 90-minute sessions generally, but with people with IDD, it varies greatly. You might have to have shorter sessions due to people's attention span. You may have to have longer sessions due to processing speed. So it's very individualized. But we do find that sessions need to end doing something fun to allow the person to recenter before leaving therapy. Grounding exercises are essential, recreational activities, ending sessions and being mindful about when we're doing exposure therapy, it's critical to do some grounding before the sessions end. A coach is really, really important. And one of the things about, I think is very typical is that parents or caregivers are the primary caregivers are the ones that serve as coaches. But I just wanna say that with people with IDD, because of the types of people that are in their life, many paid caregivers, sometimes a lack of natural supports, you have to be creative as who serves as a coach. So it can be non-conventional who can serve as a coach. You just really have to take a look at the folks that are involved in the client's life that are willing to commit to regularly attending sessions, maybe even by phone. So these are the phases of treatment. We have assessment, addressing safety issues, psychoeducation, skill development, doing the trauma narrative, and then processing the narrative and reintegration. So going through this, let's talk quickly about assessment. The NCTSN Baseline Trauma Assessment is a form that's was used by the National Child Traumatic Stress Network in order to get their baseline data. And it is basically for recording all of the instances historically of trauma. It's a fantastic form. It's very detailed, but it's very comprehensive. And it's why I like it very much for getting background information. And then for assessing severity of trauma symptoms, UCLA PTSD Index is fantastic, as well as the trauma symptom checklist for children, because again, these are developed for academic and developmental levels that are much younger than what's typical for adults. So some of the adaptations you have to be aware of when working with people with IDD is be sure to check all the significant caretakers, are often several, and then you have to assess for secondary trauma due to the societal community response or lack thereof. You know, you have to check in their systems and the people around them, their supports. Do they have assumptions that they can't benefit, that they weren't impacted by the trauma, or they can't benefit from therapy? Lack of availability of appropriate treatments often result in significant delays in providing assistance. So these are all things that are specific, that are really unique to the people with IDD when you're doing an assessment. And when we're taking a look at addressing safety issues, understand that people can't enter into trauma treatment if they're still in unsafe environments. So looking at the safety of their current environments, what are the risks for re-traumatization? Does the client need support to deal with ongoing environmental stressors? Are there cognitive distortions that increase the current perception of danger? And so it's very important that these are key elements of assessing safety and assessing risk, because it's critical to moving on to the next components. And when we talk about psychoeducation, that's actually something that happens from the very beginning of the process, actually even through in the beginning of the assessment, is we have to start off by providing to the client and their caregivers general education about the impact of trauma on normal functioning. We have to provide specific information about the trauma and the client experienced in language that's accessible to the client. And we have to teach the child and parent about TF-CBT phases and how the treatment will progress. And there is an element of the power of suggestion. One of the reasons that we have manualized treatments is because it gives the therapist confidence that this is evidence-based, that it does work, and that way we can convey that confidence to our clients when we're supporting them. And so that psychoeducation piece and just not only working about what are the normal and normalizing the effects of trauma on people, but also psychoeducation around developmental disability, learning styles, and things like that may be also essential for caregivers, and as education for the clinician as well. So when you go into skills development and skills training, this may be the area which is much more extended for people with IDD because of the learning challenges. But I want to say, I want to stress that I have worked with multiple individuals who may have full-scale IQs that are in the 50s that can understand and really grasp the concepts around the cognitive triangle, the relationship between our thoughts and our feelings and our behaviors. You do have to use a lot of visuals and pair with real-life situations that people can understand, but we typically have to start with feelings identification. And so we can learn, how many feelings does my client understand in terms of the complexity of the feelings that they experience? And so we may have to do some of that skill development around feelings identification and develop their vocabulary and broaden their understanding of the various feelings that they have and experience. And then we start teaching personal relaxation skills. Unfortunately, because of the time, we don't have a whole lot of, I can't go deep into how we go about doing that, but it's very similar to what we do working with children in terms of deep breathing exercises, belly breathing exercises, isometrics, focusing on the breath. There's lots of different skills that we actually use with younger children that seem to be applicable and work very well with older children, adolescents and adults with developmental disabilities. We can teach some other thought stopping capabilities using analogies like changing the channel. Sometimes if you can help people understand, we can change the channel with our television. We can also change the channel when it comes to our thoughts. And we have to teach the caregivers these as well so that they can reinforce them and model them in various environments. So the big adaptations to this phase is that we have to restrict the number of feelings you teach If you often see those little magnets that say how I feel today, and there's like 25 different faces on it, those are typically too much. We restrict it down. We use either very concrete drawings or pictures from the internet, and maybe restrict it down to 5 or 6, and then and build from there. Build a basic vocabulary about the key concepts that we're teaching. Use multisensory teaching tools, and then use lots of repetition in creative ways. And use lots of examples that are related to the child's everyday life. And one of the things we just have to recognize is we have to change our expectations and don't become frustrated if they don't get the idea right away. I can say through testimonial that if we stay consistent and we stay persistent, we can get to the place where people really do understand the relationships between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and can start to understand how they can intervene and interrupt in any one of those relationships. And then we get to the trauma narrative, which is actually the exposure therapy piece to this. We always start with a chapter on All About Me. Positive identity development is key to this model. And so when we start writing a narrative, which is typically because 85% of people with IDD are in the mild range. So the majority of people that we have used this model with have the capability of speaking their narrative while the therapist types on the computer. And then we check for comprehension. We check to make sure that it's accurate. And then we illustrate that narrative either through drawings or through photographs or things that we find on the internet. But we use ways in order to illustrate it as well as to tell the story. And we start with All About Me. And that All About Me, our goal as we develop the narrative is to separate out the person and their capabilities and their resilience and all of the positives and the strengths that they have, as opposed to simply what happened. Because with typical people experiencing PTSD, it's not unusual that it's intertwined, that I am the trauma, I'm damaged, this is forever. And we want to separate those. So we start with chapters about All About Me, and we start to move into, and we use the baseline trauma assessment to guide our work. Some people want to go from the least threatening to the most challenging, which is understandable. Some people might want to just write the trauma components on a slip of paper and draw one out at a time to work on. But after all known aspects of trauma have been covered, ask about what the worst part was, and don't ever assume that you know what it is. You will have a reaction to the trauma history in terms of what you think is the most traumatizing, but this is very, very subjective. And so you always have to let the client guide that process. So the adaptations that are needed for people with IDD is to be creative in which the narrative recorded. Writing may not be practical. So we typically dictate responses to the therapist and who documents them in some way. We can do it through pictures. We have done tape and video recording or still camera photographs. We have done role play, even as simple as just developing a sing or a dance or a rap. And that is the narrative. We consider using Santray. I had the joy of working with a certified play therapist who taught me skills on youth will and adults will play out some of their traumas in a play setting. And you can document those through photographs or recordings, but don't be frustrated if your client again returns repeatedly to inaccurate or unhelpful cognitions, because that repetition is necessary for the learning and really the rewiring of these experiences. So in the narrative sessions, we start by each session by doing a check-in. And so scaling, we used to use thermometers until I realized that a lot of young people now don't know what a mercury thermometer is. So we started to use things like volcanoes, but it's important to have some sort of visual scaling so that you can check in to see where the person is in their stress level in the session. If it's high, then we use our skills and practice skills right there in the session to achieve mastery. With the client, we review the narrative that's was developed last time. We continue to use stress management skills as needed, checking in on stress level frequently as the person develops the new parts of the narrative. We add new information that the client brings up, and we go on to the next part of the trauma narrative. So after meeting with a client, we spend some time alone with the caregiver. We review the information the client has produced in the narrative. We help the caregiver deal with their own emotions regarding the narrative and discuss any distortions the caregiver is likely to experience, that unwarranted self-blame or unrealistic expectations of what they can do. fears that the client may be damaged forever. These are all things that we have to not only work with the client, but their support system. And each session should end with time to do something fun. We have to, and that can be anything from we used to go for walks and look at birds. We'd shoot some baskets. We'd do origami. I mean, it really just depends on the client and what their interests are, but we spend a little activity time just regrounding. But be prepared to suggest some fun things, you know, and check in with your client about how do we want to end our sessions. And then we get to the trauma processing, which is an important part where once the trauma narrative is developed, then we want to go over it with the client, review the narrative, and then we start to identify thoughts that are not helpful that are in the narrative. We start to identify areas where thoughts and feelings are missing. So we start to fill in the gaps. Somebody may be talking about the thoughts that they had, but they didn't identify the feelings. So we go and add those in. We identify places where the client's thoughts are accurate and be prepared to praise those and really reinforce those. And then, you know, add to the chapter on starting therapy and the process and the progress that the child is making. And again, I keep using most of my slides have the word child in there, and I don't mean to, because this was a child-based model, I think that crept into most of the text. But again, this has been shown to be effective with adults as well. So the adaptations that are needed when you process the narrative is to go slowly, take more time, provide lots of support, review the skills as needed. It's particularly important to use the cognitive triangle and have that visual up so that we can always see the relationship between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Identify cognitive distortions or unhelpful thoughts, then correct them in the narrative. And I just want to add that there's some really great tools, especially that I've learned from work child therapists, things like responsibility pie, which is a pie chart. And the individual can basically assign a visual representation of their responsibility in events. And that's where we can actually work visually with somebody to say, hey, is this accurate? And tell me why. And how could it be maybe different? And so there's lots of tools like that unfortunately we don't have the time to go into today. But I just wanted to stress that those are the types of things that we use in order to develop the narrative and also to process the narrative. And then as we get through this and we're starting to recognize that our client is using these skills in high stress situations, they're using them when they're processing their narrative, they're able to talk more openly and easily with their caregivers about their trauma narrative, the caregivers are able to effectively support and provide positive feedback and reinforcement to the individual who's developing and processing their narrative, then we're getting ready to be ending treatment. And we can start to think about the reintegration phase, which is generally done with the caregiver and the client together. And we begin by assessing the client's readiness for this phase, but we also have to assess the caregiver's readiness for this phase. And when we think that that's accurate, then we start to remind everyone about the rationale for these joint sessions. And the rationale is basically the caregiver has the opportunity to demonstrate their comfort in hearing and talking about the trauma while also modeling appropriate coping. And then the client has the opportunity to share the narrative and the experience as a sense of pride. And that further reduces the feelings of shame, distress, and other feelings associated with the trauma. And then the communication about the trauma is really enhanced and misunderstandings and area of confusion are cleared up and the groundwork is laid for the discussion of trauma to continue after formal therapy is over with. So they can continue to use these skills going forward when they reflect on or talk about the traumatic experience that they've had. For the clients, you should always emphasize the importance of communicating openly to eliminate misunderstandings, and caregivers should emphasize their desire to be helpful and supportive. And those are the rationales for the reintegration phase. When you're done, the client shares the trauma narrative they develop with caregivers. Caregivers praise their work, ask open-ended questions, answer the client's questions. And one of the things that I would probably add here also is that you might have to do a little boundaries work at this point. If you're familiar with the Circles curriculum, we do something similar when we talk about who we can share our trauma narrative with, who we should share our narrative with, who may not be a good person to share it with. And we may do some boundaries work in addition to in the reintegration phase. Because that's what we're doing. The client, the caregiver and client discuss give together the lessons learned, the application of those lessons, and we talk about plans for the future. And the caregiver client discussed the use of affect regulation skills for other life stressful situations. So those regulation skills can be used in all kinds of stressful incidents moving forward that are not just simply about related to the past traumas. Again, be sure the client has sufficient support in all environments. Work on specific ways in which the skills can be generalized to various situations in a client's life. When working with children who are developmentally disabled, is more likely. So the cultural competency piece, I can't stress enough, is that you have to understand that working with people with IDD is more like working with typical folks than it is different. I think that for the folks that are here at this conference, I think that that's something that you know and you understand, but you also understand that the general public may not understand that. Or clinicians who haven't worked with this population may have assumptions about that this is not within their wheelhouse, that this is operating outside of their scope of practice. And that simply is not the case. The only way that people get a cultural competency for this population is in the same way they get cultural competencies around other special populations. But one thing you do have to recognize and appreciate is that people with IDD as a small subpopulation of our community is a very diverse group. So these are some of the cultural things that we have to help push in our field to recognize that people with developmental disabilities are the only minority group in our community whose minority status is defined by a medical diagnosis. And because of that unique factor, we allow the healthcare system to discriminate based on disability. And so I always stress anytime I talk with a group, we have to re-educate the community about diagnostic overshadowing, that the over-attribution of mental health symptomology to a person's disability. And that simply is not the case. And that's for the behavioral health providers as well as the IDD support providers. We have to stop doing that and recognize there's nothing indicative to a disability that causes people behavioral and emotional dysregulation. And the one last thing I want to say about that also is that there's a potential for us to be doing a second diagnostic overshadowing, which is I also see that clinicians will misattribute trauma symptomology to other psychopathology, and we get lots of misdiagnosis of ADHD, impulse control disorders, not otherwise specified, mood disorders and psychotic disorders that are actually trauma symptoms. So we have to re-educate not only the general population, but also clinicians about that those two types of diagnostic overshadowing. So I know we're getting close to time here to open it up for question and answer, but where do we go from here? So the first next step is to develop an adapted manual for TF-CBT. Well, the good news is that we can check that one off. I'm very excited about the fact that adapted manual is available through the University of South Carolina and the TF-CBT website. But we also have to include detailed suggestions for adaptation of the model at each stage of treatment. We have to collect pilot data regarding the effectiveness of the modifications, which we have already started to do. The STRIDE group out of Long Island Jewish Medical Center actually did a great survey of trauma TF-CBT certified clinicians on the utilization of this model with people with IDD. That was very positive. It was very validating. The things that you heard me say today actually were reinforced by that study to say that those are the accurate adaptations that people are making. So make those changes in the adaptations as necessary and continue to hone that model. And then ultimately, we'd love to conduct randomized controlled studies to be sure that the adapted model is as effective in treating trauma as the same as the original model. So with that, I would love to open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you so very much, Brian, for describing why individuals with disabilities are more likely to experience trauma and how important it is to provide appropriate treatment, in this case, trauma-focused CBT, in an adapted fashion. If it's okay, I have one burning question right now, and yes. Maybe start with that and then go to the Q&A afterwards. So can you elaborate more on the coaching aspect? As it seems that coaches can play a big role, but they're not necessarily involved in the therapy part. And also, is there training that's needed for coaches?
Identifying coaches is a key component. And obviously, the primary caregivers and support people are typically the best, but they actually are involved in the treatment to some degree. That's why the model is working with coaches and caregivers alongside the individual that they're supporting, and so there's a concurrent treatment process that's happening where we're educating and we're teaching the skills to the caregivers and to the coaches, and then teaching those skills to the individual, and then we're coaching the coaches on how to support these skills. And how to support if they do re-experience, if they do have trauma flashbacks, to understand and normalize that and provide better trauma-informed support within the environments. So it's just that coaches may sometimes be paid caregivers, and that's not too unusual for this population. But they should be very much involved in the treatment and understanding specifically what language is being taught, what skills are being taught, how to reinforce it in various environments, as well as how to support and listen emotionally when the client does disclose their trauma history and process their narrative.
Okay, thank you. And it's probably so important that the clients themselves decide who should be the coaches.
Absolutely.
What information to be shared. So the first question has to do with nonverbal clients.
Yes.
And the question is, are there models of this process? How do you adapt for non-speaking autistic people?
That's a great question. And the answer to that is that we use nonverbal interventions. We use much more visual. And again, it always depends on when we talk about, you know, non-speaking autistic people. You know, that within itself is a wide range of individuals who may or may not have intellectual disabilities. Now, is there sort of a line in which you realize that this model is not effective and not useful because of a person's intellect and their ability to communicate? Yes, the answer to that is it is. You may recognize that the skill building piece and the trauma narrative may not be able to be completed. But using lots of sand tray and lots of drawing and nonverbal visual types of interventions and teaching methods that are at the person's level. So it's really the utilization of pictures, drawings, sand tray. We have used toys and other types of play therapy tools, but I think mostly that's also where the person, the coach, is able to teach the clinician about what this person's strengths are, what their capabilities are, and then working with that caregiver to recognize what's the best approach here. So is it an ideal for non-speaking autistic people? I think that it is related to their intellectual capacity, as well as what tools have they, and again, learning from their schooling years too, and what interventions and things were helpful when they were in special education. Those are things that we can learn from the caregiver so that we can conceptualize the case and figure out how we can use nonverbal interventions in order to process, in order to develop a narrative and to teach the skills. It's so individualized, but I also want to say is that you may come to agreement with a coach and caregiver that this model may not be appropriate for the individual because of their functioning level.
So really you're focusing on the adapted aspect, and the adapted is not one size fits all, but really depends on the client and the importance of making sure that you get feedback from your client and coaches.
Absolutely.
So another question, so thank you for sharing this. I became aware of the adapted TFCBT model a couple years ago, and I'm grateful. Do you know anyone who is using EMDR?
Yes, EMDR is, I have to say that there's not a lot of controlled studies about the effectiveness of EMDR with this population. What I find at the intersection of mental health and developmental disabilities is organizations like NADD. There's a lot of mental health professionals around the country, North America and Canada, that are using EMDR. And they're reporting anecdotally that this is actually ideal for the population. that the, again, when you can find effective, especially neurological interventions that don't rely on verbal processing, then we're going in the right direction. And so I can say anecdotally that there are people, there are clinicians around North America that are using EMDR with this population, and the feedback has been really positive. But we still have a long way to go before we understand. You know, I have not seen a study yet that shows any outcomes, unfortunately, not yet. And I think it's coming though.
And can you describe in a couple of sentences what EMDR is?
I'm not an EMDR trained clinician. I have worked with EMDR trained clinicians, but bilateral stimulation and basically pairing some of the trauma exposure type of narrative with bilateral stimulation of the brain is basically what EMDR is. And it can be, and what I've also find fascinating too, is that since the pandemic, there have been adaptations to doing remote EMDR work that involve audio as well as visual bilateral stimulation. So that it continues to evolve as a model.
So another question is, how do you address ongoing medical trauma? So when the trauma is, it's not in the past, but it's ongoing.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think that we can spend a lot of time doing, we can always stay in the skill building phase. So we wouldn't be processing a trauma narrative that's not yet a narrative. It's happening in real life, but we can always stay in the skill building phase where we're teaching people regulation skills. And there's a whole nother, what I always want to stress is that what typically works for people with IDD is what works for people who don't have an IDD. And so there's a lot of research and practice out there about pain management and how to manage chronic pain and things like that, that I want to stress to clinicians can be adapted to people with IDD. So whenever I'm asked a question like, well, what model should we use for people with IDD? I then go back to, well, what model are we using for people without IDD? And that's the direction we should head in. Because again, I think that this is more of a cultural competency. And if you have an understanding about how to meet your client where they are with their language and with the abilities that they do have, then we can adapt what works for the general population.
So we may be coming to our last question. Are there any controlled studies of the application of the adapted TFCBT model with the IDD population?
Sorry, say it one more time. I'm not seeing it in the chat.
It's actually in the Q&A.
Oh, it's in the Q&A. I'm sorry. Can you repeat it just one more time?
Sure. Which is, are there any controlled studies of the application of adapted TFCBT model with the IDD population?
No, that is the next step. Now that we've actually written the manual, we can go to doing controlled studies. So that has not happened yet. But again, I think that the manual has been a huge leap forward, because now TFCBT therapists across the country can access that manual. And then once we get more people that feel comfortable and competent applying the model, then we can start studying the outcomes. But I feel that that's the next step that NCTSN will take in this. They have been moving from the very beginning of just building educational materials like the Road to Recovery, now developing the manual. I think the next thing is to show the effectiveness of the manual.
Well, thank you so very much. I think we can definitely keep going on, but one of the audience did ask if we could put in a link about where the manual is located.
Yes.
That's published. Okay.
Yes, let me get that, and I can cut and paste it into the chat. I think I can do that from, or maybe I can do that and make it available in the, because I know we have to move on with the program. There's maybe a way I can do that from backstage.
Sure, that'd be great. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for your wonderful work that you all are doing. If you don't get that message enough from the community, let me add to it. The work that you all are doing is so critically important and valuable. And thank you. And thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.